From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Many big ideas have struggled over the centuries to dominate the planet. Fascism. Communism. Democracy. Religion. But only one has achieved total supremacy. Its compulsive attractions rob its followers of reason and good sense. It has created unsustainable inequalities that threaten to tear apart the very fabric of our society.
More powerful than any cause or even religion, it has reached into every corner of the globe. It is consumerism.
I lost in the supermarket. I can no longer shop happily.
But what is consumerism? Isn't it just a posh way to describe shopping? We're all consumers, after all. We all go shopping.
And I'll make sure I get all my payments in right on time.
Now wait a minute, buddy. Let me go back here and do a little checking on you.
Then the man, he come back, he say, I'm sorry, my man, but your
credit didn't go through.
Why would you mean?
Don't know why the kind of stuff you throw away, I'll buy on eBay.
What I bought on eBay.
As that montage indicates, today we explore consumerism. We'll investigate a new kind of economics called Scroogenomics and our obsession with low prices. Also, we'll look at the consumerist pop art of Andy Warhol. And Chuck Klosterman shares his thoughts on advertising. But first, Rob Walker. Walker writes the weekly column Consumed for the New York Times Magazine. He's also the author of a book called Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. Walker talked to Steve Paulson about branding.
First of all, my view of branding is that sometimes people think like, well, is it the logo design or is it the ad? And it's those are elements, but really branding is the process of attaching some kind of idea to something. 100 years ago, that idea might have just been quality, but today you see the ideas attached to things are more and more aimed at, they're bigger for one thing. Like you, I'm sure you're familiar with the Dove campaign for real beauty, mm-hmm. for facial creams and stuff like that. And they're making a statement about the nature of beauty itself. That's a pretty big idea to try to communicate through a brand. But the second part of it is that it is a two-way process. It's never just a company sort of announces something and says, this is what our brand means. And so therefore that's the end of the story. Consumers participate in that, and they're either willing to participate in the idea that the company puts forth. In that case, people have clearly been willing to go buy magazines that have interviews with the women in the Dove ads in them and have water cooler conversations and text in their votes and things like that. But then there are other examples of things like Timberland boots or Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, where essentially new meanings for a brand were created by consumers, and the company had to come around and adjust to what the consumers had decided the brand meant.
These are some fascinating stories. For instance, Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, which frankly was a beer that kind of everyone had forgotten about.
Yeah.
And then somehow it was rediscovered without really the company itself knowing that.
Yeah, and it literally sort of year over year for a quarter of a century, their sales were declining, which is a pretty tough thing to reverse in general. And they finally had dropped below, I think, 1 million barrels a year, which is kind of a threshold of, wow, they've really fallen off the map for something that used to be a mass brand. And kind of almost for fluky reasons, it was picked up in Portland as kind of the beer of choice of kind of young bike messengers and college students and stuff like that for reasons having to do with a local brewer going out of business. And that was kind of the cheap beer. The company itself had no idea why this was happening. Why are people picking it up and what does it mean to them? And they had to sort of dispatch one of their employees out to Portland to look around and meet these people and figure out what it meant to them. And it turned out that one of the attractions for these young folks was the idea that it was kind of a dead or dying beer, which meant that there was no marketing around it. It kind of had an outsider anti-marketing vibe to it almost. I went out to Portland to talk to some of these people, and they told me, well, I like the fact that they're not they're not in your face with advertising, and I hate all that advertising. So it kind of became, PBR kind of became the anti-brand brand.
It creates a dilemma then for the company. They suddenly realize, oh, it's kind of become hip, not for anything that we did, but for other reasons. How do we take advantage of this? We can't really create an advertising campaign because that'll kill it.
Well, they did something pretty clever. And they did think through all that. And their first instinct was, in fact, oh, good, we'll advertise on alternative rock radio or something. And then they kind of figured out that that would be a bad idea. And instead, what they did was they kind of sidled up to these groups, these like bike messengers who would play goofy bike polo games in the park and stuff like that. And they would say, well, why don't we give you $500? You know, we'll be the sponsor of it. You can buy some new equipment, or we'll just give you beer if you'll kind of, you know, there wasn't even a quid pro quo, really. It was just sort of a building the word of mouth kind of strategy. And it worked really well because the bike messengers there would alert their bike messenger friends in San Francisco and New York and everywhere else to say, hey, these PBR guys, they'll help you out. And that ended up being a major spreader of kind of the anti-establishment, if you want to call it that, cachet that PBR picked up. And it's continued to this day.
And these bike messengers and sort of the other people they hang out with, they don't feel like they're getting used doing this?
Well, no. By and large, I mean, I think that they feel that they're participating in it. You know, I'm sure that the answers will vary depending on which individual you're talking to, and some people do walk away and so on. But, you know, the ones that I spoke to, their feeling was, look, we don't really care about what the agenda of PBR is. We have our agenda, which is that we get some beer and we get to have our games in the park, and we don't care about them. So they can do what they want.
Now, you've coined a word to describe this kind of thing, marketing, which is not exactly marketing, but it's sort of, I don't guess, the new version of marketing.
Yeah, it's the murkier version of marketing, and that's why I use that word. And that came about through reporting on stories like this one. I would say it became emblematic to me of the shift on the other side of the coin when we talk about things like TiVo or the internet and other technologies that kind of give us more control over traditional forms of advertising or the ability to avoid traditional forms of advertising. Once it became clear that, well, we can zap past 30-second ads, that the advertising industry wasn't going to sit still and say, oh, well, you know, we give up and we roll over and call our clients and say, forget it. Instead, they had to come up with new tactics, new ways of getting at people, and these murkier tactics where it's not even clear, well, is that an ad or is that something else? You see it in forms like these things like with PBR that happen completely outside of media, but also increasingly you see it in media itself with shows in which the sponsor is kind of integrated into the program.
Hmm. And then on the other hand, there are stories like Timberland boots, sort of this old line outdoor boot for hiking that somehow became hip in cities.
Yeah. And this is a case of consumers coming up with a different set of meanings for a brand than what the brand managers had in mind. The people who owned Timberland had a very clear idea of what they were all about, and it was sort of a combination of outdoor and sort of New England factory man, you know, very blue-collar kind of image. And it was picked up by a much different consumer, which was an urban kind of hip-hop consumer, African-American in the beginning. And then as hip-hop became a bigger idea across the culture, it was, of course, picked up in the suburbs as well, and all kinds of people who, it just became sort of a standard uniform almost of hip-hop culture. And there was a period when the company really resisted this and did not want to see their product as, in effect, a fashion product. They were frightened by that. They didn't like the idea that it would be in effect fashion because they saw themselves as being very function-oriented. And eventually, they essentially capitulated to what the consumer wanted and started manufacturing pink and blue and different colored Timberland boots because that's what the consumer wanted. And the meaning of the brand had fundamentally changed. And things like advertising in Vibe magazine, which they had resisted, they decided that they had to do because that's where the consumer was.
So why would these hip-hop people ever take to Timberland boots, you know, this outdoor recreational boot?
Well, to some degree, the answers to that involve just passing along legends, which I guess is what I'll do. I mean, the story goes that the Timberland boots actually also hold up very well in the urban environment and the sort of broken glass and that kind of thing, but also particularly among, and please let me just be clear that this is probably folklore, but drug dealers in the beginning who were out on the street all night also needed warm, waterproof boots, and these were the highest end best. They were actually using them for functional reasons. But as we've seen in other scenarios, the line gets a little blurry about who sets trends and things like that. And it was clearly before long adapted by people. And you see them in suburbs to this day. They get sort of young hip-hop kids who have absolutely, they could probably be barefoot. The streets are so clean, but the Timberland boots are the ones to wear.
You end your book with a quote from Chuck D of the rap group Public Enemy, who's talking about the make something from nothing culture that he thought was a big part of the early days of hip-hop. And Chuck D said, "It was you that was important, and everything else would define you after you defined yourself. It wasn't like a brand defined you. You defined the brand." Do you think we've reached that point in our society?
Well, I use that quote because he's saying something in a really memorable way that is said in other ways by people who have studied this stuff with more of an academic bent. And it's really easy to get lost in this process. And a lot of advertising is meant to kind of get you into a position where it's aspiration that you're buying. You're buying things that reflect the person that you want to be. And this is true even with sort of virtuous products like the eco-friendly dishwashing detergent or something like that. Hey, you want to be participating in solving the Earth's problems. Why don't you buy this brand of detergent? Meanwhile, you're not really changing your behavior in any way. So it's not actually reflecting who you are. It's kind of reflecting something that you want to be, or you're hoping that it will somehow turn you into that person. And I think, you know, we're in this shaky economic moment right now where a lot of people are rethinking their consumer habits. And I think that his words and the general point is really well taken. And now, in a funny way, is a great opportunity to really stop and say, what is important to me and how should my consumer decisions reflect that as opposed to the other way around?
Rob Walker is the author of Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. He also writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine. Walker spoke with Steve Paulson. You can find a link to Walker's website on our website at ttbook.org.
Fast Blue River!
Chuck Klosterman has chronicled rock music, film, and sports for nearly 15 years. His new collection of essays is called Eating the Dinosaur. One of the essays is called It Will Shock You How Much It Never Happened. In this essay, Klosterman explores the world of advertising, including the popular AMC cable TV series Mad Men. As he told Steve Paulson,
"When you watch Mad Men, they really, you know, it's a great program, but they really glamorized, to a degree almost lionized, the idea of the ad man. And the main character, Don Draper, there's one episode in the first season where he's selling the Kodak carousel for, like, showing vacation slides. This was a new product in the 60s. And, you know, he comes to this realization that we're not selling people pictures of themselves. We're selling them the warmth of nostalgia, this idea that what we're selling is not really what we're selling.
This device isn't a spaceship. It's a time machine. It goes backwards and forwards. It takes us to a place where we ache to go again. It's not called the wheel. It's called the carousel."
Now, everybody knows that's how advertising works now. When you see it in Mad Men, it's sort of exciting. It's like, oh, so this was the beginning of tricking people into buying stuff, you know. But now everyone's aware of that, and they love the idea of that. And they all feel like they understand advertising as much as the ad people do. So we almost do the work for the advertiser now. I mean, you'll notice that, say, after the Super Bowl, everybody watches those Super Bowl ads, and then they put them up on blogs, and they talk about them, and they almost inject them with their own aesthetic meaning, that they kind of take these things that are just supposed to, say, sell, you know, Pepsi or diapers or whatever, and we change the meaning of how artistic they are. I mean, now like a commercial is perceived by most people as a kind of art. But can something be art if its principal motivation is to move a product? I don't think so. I think that the idea of something is artful that its primary purpose can't be to move product. So now the advertiser can just do that, can just try to sell something, and then the consumer will make it into art. Mm-hmm.
You know? Well, I have friends, actually, who are not football fans, but they tape the Super Bowl, fast forward through the game just to watch the ads.
And why?
For exactly that reason. I mean, you know, supposedly these are the best ads of the year, and they want to, you know, see how they're done.
Lots of people like that. But if you ask them, why do you want to see the best ad of the year, how would they describe it?
I don't know. Original? I don't know. Good question.
My suspicion is that they would probably, if they're smart, use the same language people use when talking about paintings or film. All of these things that the advertiser doesn't even have to do anymore. The fact that they bought airtime during the Super Bowl pretty much validates the fact that this is meaningful to people. So people then will create the meaning for it. It's like we're working for Don Draper. The idea that the advertiser has to come up with some kind of brilliant ad to make us buy Nutter Butter cookies, I think that's over now. All they need to do is just present the ad that has the Nutter Butters. Our knowledge of advertising makes us think this is a really creative, important venture. And then we will sort of give it all sort of the merit and weight that an actual artist dreams of getting, you know, like somebody who's a painter dreams of people taking their work seriously and looking for meanings about culture within their art. But if you have a Super Bowl ad, it's almost like a de facto statement about where our culture is.
On the other hand, I mean, don't you have the experience sometimes where you watch this and it might be a really clever ad, but you kind of find yourself wondering now, what did that have to do with the product that's being sold? I mean, anything?
That's why I say I think very often that the main thing an advertisement does is tell people that the product, the pre-existing product, is successful enough that the people who make it can buy advertising. So other people must like it.
I mean what's interesting is, I mean, that the counter logic would be, oh, I should buy something that is never advertised because they can sell it for less because they're not spending any money on advertising. And so it's, you know, I get a good deal in the store by buying that thing. But it does go against this sort of idea of what is successful.
Because you say, like, well, advertising must work. Well, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So basically, if there was no advertising, we'd be in the same situation. Sometimes products would sell and sometimes they wouldn't. I mean, there's certainly tons of products that are advertised that fail. Does that prove that advertising is – I think what it basically proves is that advertising is probably, in its tangible form, is more guesswork and more of a crapshoot than we realize.
Would you mind ending by reading actually the very last part of your essay?
Like all people who pretend they're smart, I want to feel immune to this. I avoid advertising. Since the advent of digital video recorders – I rarely watch TV commercials, even when they come on during live sporting events. I wrote a column in Esquire for 5 years, yet I can't think of one company who advertised alongside my work. I know advertisements were there, but I can't remember any of them. I've never read a pop-up or a banner ad on the internet. Does anyone? Even if I watch Survivor at CBS.com, I check my email during the unclosable commercial that precedes the episode. Obviously, I'm not the only person who does this. Yet, somehow, I still know about new things that are available to purchase. I can sense when I'm a target market. I knew that Pepsi was focused on optimism long before I saw any new logos or press releases. So how could this be? How is it that ideas I never think about still burrow into my head? Why do I understand an ad campaign I completely avoid? I enjoy Don Draper. He's got a lot of quality suits. But I'm afraid I might be his employer, and I don't even know it.
Chuck Klosterman, reading from his essay, It Will Shock You How Much It Never Happened. It's from his new book, Eating the Dinosaur. Klosterman spoke with Steve Paulson. So what do you think about advertising? Does it work? Or are we immune to it? We'd love to know what you think. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, the high cost of our lust for low prices. And Scroogenomics, why you shouldn't buy presents for the holidays. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Ellen Rappel Shell is a journalism professor at Boston University and the author of Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. In the book, Shell explores the effects that our obsession with low prices has had on us, as she told Anne Strangechamps.
The idea of bargains, of course, is a very venerable idea and a noble one on many levels. You know, the ancient bazaar was a place where we bargained for the best possible value for ourselves and our families. The difference is in the ancient bazaars, you generally knew who you were bargaining with, or you knew his family, or you knew his neighbors, you knew where he lived. And as a consequence, this bargaining was really a way to get to a fair price where the merchant would make enough to sustain himself and his business, and you would be able to afford it. If you couldn't afford something, you would go elsewhere. But that was the bargaining method. Now, of course, that's all become distorted in today's market. But what I discovered doing this book was that the discounting of things is actually a relatively recent phenomenon. There's been discounting since the Industrial Revolution, of course, made mass manufactured goods available. But the heavy discounting and the ubiquitous discounting is really a phenomenon that's only about 20 to 30 years old. In fact, in the 1950s, only about 5% of clothing, for example, was offered on discount. Now that number is closer to 75%. Of clothing. So we buy more clothing on discount than we do not on discount, for example, and we buy across the board about 33% of consumer goods at a discount. So discounting has become the marketing philosophy, the basic drive in business. It's just become a pervasive phenomenon. And again, the book gave me the opportunity, hopefully the readers, the opportunity to explore that in all its glory and also its drawbacks.
What are the main risks you see with the contemporary obsession with low prices?
Oh, wow. There are so many. Cheap goods imply cheap workers, right? So as we squeeze the supply chain, demanding more and more low prices and lower prices, right down from the seller all the way back down to the manufacturer, all the way back down to the raw materials, as we demand lower and lower prices, we have to pay lower and lower wages, right? It goes without saying. And through the 1970s up until now, the wage of the American worker has been flat or declining. Job security as well has declined significantly. I think we're all aware of that. At the same time that the cost of consumer goods has declined dramatically. But simultaneously, I think we're also aware that the cost of things we can't live without, that is housing, healthcare, education, daycare, have skyrocketed. So the American worker, in particular the middle class, is in this pinch. We can get cheaper and cheaper T-shirts in part because our wages and benefits have either been frozen or have declined in the last 30 years. That's contributed greatly to the stagnation of wages and benefits in the United States. Also to the outsourcing. Obviously, these goods, some of them cannot be made at those prices in the United States. They have to be made elsewhere in low-wage countries. And part of what's going on when we have this deep, deep discounting is just like Woolworth scoured the globe for the lowest possible prices, American and multinational companies do the same thing. And where they tend to go is where the rule of law is weakest, because obviously a country that does not enforce human rights or environmental laws, or even has them, is going to be able to do the work at a lower price. At the same time, we're kind of cannibalizing our own workforce and threatening our own stability. We are contributing to this in the developing world. So it's not a great outcome, I think, for us. And I think it's come back to haunt us.
You uncovered some really interesting facts, most of them suggesting that even when Americans are really keen on getting bargains, in fact, we may be getting fewer bargains than we think. For instance, I was surprised to learn that outlet malls are America's number one travel destination. They get more visitors every year than Times Square, Disney World, and even the Grand Canyon combined. But you discover that the outlet malls don't offer the bargains that a lot of shoppers think they're getting.
Right. The outlet malls are just a wonderful example of something called reference pricing. Reference pricing, and we've all experienced this, and boy, have I, because I used to be a total dupe for reference pricing. To use a very simple example, if you buy a sweater, and the sweater is $50, but the original price was $250, that original price is what we call the reference price. That's the price that's on there, the higher, maybe the manufacturer's suggested price. But that is the reference price, and that's what you assume the object is worth.
So you go home and you think, wow, I got a great deal. I just got a $250 sweater for $50.
Absolutely. And I used to do this all the time. I would come home and tell my husband, oh, look, I bought these for $30. And he'd say, but they're worth. And then he'd pause with a big grin on his face. And of course, I'd always say, oh, but they were worth three times as much. And he'd give me this kind of quizzical look and go back into whatever he's doing. But that's exactly right. And some of us more than others are really attracted to this so-called deal that we see.
But you're not going to tell me that the sweater wasn't really worth $250?
Obviously, in many cases, it wasn't. And in more and more cases, it wasn't. And that's what the outlet mall is all about. The outlet mall is generally all brand name stores. They all have names of particular brands. They're not Macy's or Bloomingdale's. They're North Face or Coach. They're brand names. And you associate those names with high quality and also high prices sometimes. So you have this reference price, this high reference price in your mind, this high quality thought in your mind when you go into an outlet store, and then you're confronted with all these low, low prices. So you assume everything in the outlet store is a deep, deep discount that you're getting, a steal. And interestingly, a lot of us just think, wow, aren't we smart to have found this really great deal? And it's not really rational. We know that outlet malls are open to everyone, but we kind of think we are the clever ones. We've kind of figured this out. I certainly felt this way, and many people do. It's sort of a subconscious reaction. But in these outlet malls, how do they get to these very, very low prices? Well, oftentimes I found that what was in the outlet malls is not offered in the traditional malls at all. You assume because the brand is there that it's the same. It is oftentimes not the same thing at all. It is manufactured deliberately for the outlet mall. And so you really don't have any idea what that object is worth.
So that Banana Republic shirt or that Coach bag you think you're buying at a great price is in fact not the same Banana Republic shirt or Coach bag that would be sold in one of their regular stores.
That's absolutely true. And I went to Coach Bag's store, actually, in the company of a business professor in Las Vegas. I went to Las Vegas because I use the metaphor of gambling when you go to an outlet mall. And she pointed out to me that the Coach Bags in the store, only two in the entire store were the Coach Bags you would get at a traditional store. And both those bags were well out of season. The in-season bags were not the Coach bags that were on offer at the traditional Coach bag store. So even though they may be, you know, well-made, good quality, you know, you can make that judgment yourself, they're not a Coach bag in the way that we think of a Coach bag.
Sounds like American shoppers are, in many instances, being scammed by the labeled discount that gets stuck on something. And you also wrote, not necessarily to pick on Walmart, but you found some evidence that up to a third of the items for sale at Walmart are actually more expensive than you'd find elsewhere, which certainly doesn't fit with the reputation Walmart has.
Absolutely. When you go into Walmart, you assume everything is going to be on deep discount. You think it's going to be the cheapest in the area. And Walmart takes advantage of that by offering about a third of its merchandise at a price higher than that in the region that it's found. So oftentimes you go in there knowing one or two specific items that are less expensive. You've checked it perhaps on the internet or you've shopped around. But we tend to overbuy in discount stores. For example, in outlet malls, we spend about 80% more than we do in a traditional mall. That's why they provide you with the shopping cart. You know, the shopping cart is not something that people used to use when they bought clothing, for example. But it is provided in discount stores. And the idea, of course, is that you're going to pile it high with merchandise. So you may come into the Walmart store, another discount store, thinking, you know, I saw this great deal on flower pots or whatever it is, sneakers, and that may be a great deal. But a lot of the other merchandise in the store is not a great deal. And you're going to throw that in your cart anyway because you're not really aware of prices. Most of us are only aware of prices of a few things. Again, discounters take advantage of that. As well, people should be aware that many discount stores, and Walmart being one of them, acquire goods that are made specifically for that store. So even though it may have a brand name on it, a reliable brand name, the supplier is providing a special form of that good for Walmart, oftentimes not to the standards that would be offered at other full-price stores.
Wow. So if you're suggesting that shoppers pay more attention to evaluating the actual product, how are consumers supposed to do that? I mean, one of the questions you ask in Cheap is, how are consumers supposed to know whether, say, the lower price of chicken breasts at Walmart signifies a really good deal on a good product or a bad deal on an inferior product?
You know, that's a very, very good question. And what I suggest is that people start asking questions. One of the examples I use in the book is shrimp, which is a food that used to be, when I was a kid, a delicacy, and now can be very, very inexpensive, so much so that we eat more shrimp in the United States than we do tuna fish, which really blew my mind. I couldn't believe it. But we do. That is so relatively inexpensive. But much of the shrimp we get, and I detail this in the book, is produced in a very unfortunate way. It's very compromising to the environment of the South Asian countries where it's made. It's led to a lot of labor abuses, human rights abuses. And the shrimp itself is not of the quality that we used to think of shrimp 30 years ago. So what I encourage consumers to do is to look to see where the shrimp comes from. Did it come from Thailand? Did it come from China? Or did it come from the United States? And in the case of shrimp, I argue that Gulf shrimp, on average, is a better product. And potentially, you can make that calculation yourself in the store. How much more is it going to cost you? Oftentimes, it may be a dollar a pound more. Sometimes, it's substantially more. If it's substantially more, you may choose not to buy shrimp. Or you may choose to buy a lower quality, a lower price shrimp. But at least you're aware of those decisions. And you're also aware of how that shrimp was farmed.
Ellen Rappel Schell is the author of Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Joel Waldfogel is the Ehrenkranz Professor and Chair of Business and Public Policy at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. He's also the author of Scroogenomics, Why You Shouldn't Buy Presents for the Holidays. Waldfogel's interest in Christmas gift-giving goes back to 1993 when he gave surveys to his students.
I simply asked students, list the items you've received as gifts. Who was the giver? What do you think the giver paid? And what would you have been willing to pay for it? And so on that basis, I could compare their willingness to pay to the price. Although I have to say, in subsequent surveys, I've really refined the methodology because it occurs to me that the relevant alternative is really stuff I buy for myself, right? So what I've subsequently come to ask people is, list the stuff you've received as gifts, who gave it to you, what do you think they paid, what is it worth to you, but then do the same thing for things you've purchased for yourself. And on that basis, having surveyed lots of people over the years, I make the claim, or I say the data make the claim, that per dollar spent, stuff that others buy for us is worth 20% less to us than stuff we buy for ourselves.
20% less. Okay, give me an example.
So a particular kind of example would be, you know, if somebody else goes out to buy a gift for you, they can spend $50. But since they don't know what you like, they might get you something that doesn't fit, something that's the wrong color. You ask yourself, what would I be willing to pay for it? Frankly, in an awful example like the one I'm describing, you wouldn't say anything near $50. You know, if you'd bought something for yourself with $50, you'd get something worth at least $50. Let's just say $60. But with that awful sweater, it doesn't fit you, the wrong color, you might say most I'd pay for it is zero. So that wouldn't be 20%, it would be 100%.
So if my grandmother, who is no longer with us and can't take offense at what I'm about to say, were to buy me a sweater that had large black and red checks because she thought it was pretty, and it was a medium and I wear an extra large, it would be worth nothing but appreciation of her generosity in giving it to me, which I suppose has some value, but monetary value, not so much.
I guess that's right. We can talk about, you know, the joy of giving and the sentimental value, because I think those are important aspects of giving. But putting those aside for the moment, right, the sweater that doesn't fit you and is a color you wouldn't wear isn't something you'd be willing to pay much for.
Right. So I guess what it comes down to is, how much do you think Americans are wasting by buying Christmas gifts that people don't especially want?
Well, my conservative estimate of how much we spend is about $65 billion per year. And I get that from the difference between December retail sales and the retail sales in months around December, November, and January. So that's the spending, not the waste. But then I apply that 20% number to it. That is the difference between the satisfaction that dollars produce when we choose things for ourselves and what dollars produce when others choose things for us. Multiplying 20% by $65 billion is $13 billion per year in missing satisfaction, or deadweight loss, as economists would prefer to say.
Now, that doesn't mean that the economy actually lost $13 billion, because that money was spent. It went into the economy, stores got their money, and businesses went forward. But in terms of return for the money, that's where the loss comes.
That's right. I mean, there are some question, you know, isn't it nevertheless good for the economy that all this spending occurs? And there's some sense in which it is good for the economy, but I think we have to remember that the economy consists of both buyers and sellers. And when we think of what is it that's good about good for the economy, well, for sellers, it's good to receive prices that exceed costs and therefore to get some profit. And it's good for buyers to receive items they value above the price they pay. And that's a kind of a consumer surplus. And normally, when we make our own decisions voluntarily and not insanely, we maximize the surplus we as buyers get, just as the sellers are maximizing their surplus. But again, the problem when others choose for us is that although sellers get what they want, buyers get less than they should have gotten or could have gotten with equivalent amounts of spending done for themselves.
Is there actually damage to the economy in some ways? Because some of this generates an idea of what the public wants that isn't realistic. And therefore, factories are in business making things that really nobody wants.
Well, I think that's exactly right. You could either think about this as, look how much we spend and we don't get as much satisfaction as we could. Or you could say, well, given how much satisfaction we're getting, aren't we wasting a lot of resources making the wrong stuff? And either way, I think, is an appropriate way to think about it.
And the retailers do these days rely very heavily on Christmas. Certainly we hear about it all the time. Christmas is, what, 40% of the annual income for some stores?
Yeah, it's a huge deal. I mean, just overall, retail sales did jump substantially in December relative to the months around it. And for certain categories, for jewelry stores, department stores, it's a huge bump in revenue and probably even a bigger bump in profit. So it is important to them.
So playing around with what people give and why they give it, is something that they worry about. They're not necessarily opposed to the kind of thing you're saying, or are they? What kind of reaction are you getting to the...
Well, I haven't heard much from these folks directly yet. Some of the things that I advocate are not at all harmful to them. Because again, I'm not advocating spending less. I'm advocating better match between what's chosen by givers and what recipients want. And a lot of innovations that they've pioneered, like gift cards, have been innovations that have really moved this process toward what you might call more efficient allocation. So I don't think in general that they're hostile to this. I think in general they want both the givers and the recipients to be happy with the stuff they get, so they want to come back and buy more at that same place.
In the research that you've done, do gift cards come out okay? I mean, are people happy to give a gift card? Do they feel as though they've done something? Are people happy to get a gift card? Do they feel as though they got something?
You know, what's so interesting is that, you know, in principle, the perfect gift, and I say this from the standpoint of being a kind of a cold-hearted economist, in principle, the perfect gift is cash. But of course, as soon as you say that, you realize it's insane. It's not the perfect gift. Psychologists have actually done lots of research documenting that cash is a very awkward gift in our society anyways. It's almost an impermissibly awkward gift between social peers. It is sort of allowed between elders and younger recipients. But despite the fact that cash is a stigmatized gift, gift cards, which are a lot like cash, although not perfectly like cash, are not socially stigmatized. They are among the most desired gifts by recipients. They're viewed as somewhat thoughtful. I mean, of course, if you're a giver and you have a good idea what your recipient wants, a gift card is sort of uninspired. But if you're in that gray region where you really don't know, but you have to give something, it's a pretty good alternative that recipients really seem to like, and it lacks the kind of awkwardness of giving dollar bills.
There is some difficulty with it, though. I've read, I guess in Scrooge-onomics you talk about this. Their gift card value is often not used. Is that because you get a gift card for $10 and you buy something worth $9, there's only a dollar left, and you think, oh, well, I'll just throw it away?
Well, I think it's a mix of that and just losing them, forgetting about them. So there is a problem. I do have a misgiving, notwithstanding that they're a step toward efficiency. They have this problem that maybe 10% of them is never redeemed. And so that means, in effect, that the giver is making a gift 90% to his recipient, but 10% to the shareholders of the retailer. Now, as an economist, I'm not as upset about that transfer as I would be about society using resources to make something that someone then puts in a closet and never uses, that latter being real waste. But still, as a human being, I think, and a person sympathetic with givers, I suspect this isn't what givers really had in mind. They didn't really want to transfer 10% of the resources over to the retailer. So I advocate, and I guess I'm told this is about as likely as world peace, but I advocate, wouldn't it be nice if retailers issued gift cards that say after 24 months, their unspent balances defaulted straight to charity? Buyers would look at the card and know that either their loved one or some worthy cause was getting all of their generosity.
I'm in favor of that, but I'm also in favor of world peace. So,
well, we could win a beauty pageant together, you and I.
I like your idea of having the excess on gift cards given to charity. Do you have any other ideas for harnessing the impulse to give Christmas gifts as a force for good?
Yeah, I do. Well, first of all, I mean, notwithstanding the subtitle of the book, I do think people should go ahead and give presents to people they know well. If you know somebody well, and the data show this, if you know people well, you see them frequently, you tend to do pretty well in choosing for them. In fact, sometimes you can do better than they would do for themselves. So go ahead and keep doing that when you have a good reason to do it and some idea. But, you know, if you don't, as we said before, gift cards are an option. And a third option that I like a lot is gifts to charity in the name of the recipient. I'll tell you why I like that idea. One of the things we try to accomplish with gift giving is to allow our recipient to experience a luxury, something that they can't normally afford. If you look at household spending data in the United States, one of the clearest luxury activities is actually cash gifts to charity. And when I say that, you know, the way economists define a luxury, it's something that occupies a higher share of expenditure for higher income households. So higher income households give a bigger share of their expenditures to charity. Now that suggests that maybe we'd all like to do that if just we had some more money. So if I were to give you a charity gift card that allowed you to choose from a list of charities, and it would become a gift in your name, I'm letting you act like a rich guy. I'm getting some resources over to some organization or individuals who really need it and therefore a high value use. And you and I both get to feel good about having done something good. So there's no value destroyed and some good done in the world. And I think, you know, for gifts among adults, you know, this would be a terrible idea for a kid, but for gifts among adults, what a nice way to discharge our obligations to give to each other.
You're making me think that world peace might be possible after all. And of course, there's one gift that I'm sure you'd say is perfect for just about everyone. That would be a copy of Scrooge-onomics.
Well, you know, I don't want to be a hypocrite here, so I think I should say each person should buy it for himself. And if you like it, buy another copy to give as a gift. If you don't like it, just go ahead and re-gift it.
Joel Waldfogel is the author of Scrooge-onomics, Why You Shouldn't Buy Presents for the Holidays. What do you think of Waldfogel's ideas about Christmas gift giving? You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. You will also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, how Andy Warhol transformed ordinary consumer products like Campbell's soup cans and Coca-Cola bottles into art. As we conclude our Hour on Consumerism, I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. David Dalton is the co-author, along with Tony Sherman, of Pop, The Genius of Andy Warhol. David Dalton and his sister Sarah were assistants on Warhol's early pop art paintings when they were in their teens. Dalton remembers Warhol as a man with big plans.
He had audacious plans like Daffy Duck. He wanted to be a famous fine artist, but he was a commercial illustrator. He wanted to be a famous movie director, and yet he didn't know how to work the camera. And he wanted to be sinister and mysterious and thought after by glamorous people. And, you know, he was very tongue-tied, a wallflower, somewhat goofy and nerdy, basically, at that point.
And so he felt comfortable with a couple of transplanted English boarding school kids.
Yeah. When we got to his house is like Hansel and Gretel's house, you know, the witch's house. As you came in, there was a pinball machine, a wooden Indian, a sort of antique candy machine. You know, we were like innocent kids looking for trouble. And here was somebody really strange and eccentric. And almost as soon as we got there, his mother, Julia, came up from the basement, and my sister had very long blonde hair, and she said, "Oh, an angel is here," and immediately embarked on several stories of gruesome martyrdoms of Czechoslovakian saints, but all told with the enthusiasm of someone describing a scene in Mary Poppins, you know, sort of like, and they put her on the wheel, and they think, you know, it's like, ah!
Actually, just about perfect for teenage kids.
Oh, yeah, of course. He lived, you know, this fantasy teen life, basically. He played pop records. He'd already started to do his pop art. And I think he'd started doing the soup cans, I think. He'd bought the idea of the soup cans from an art dealer called Muriel Latow for $100. He had seen Lichtenstein's Girl with a Ball that was at Leo Castelli's gallery, and he was freaked out because there was somebody else doing pop art. I mean, he never imagined there was anybody else doing this kind of stuff.
You tell a story in the book of actually going to a grocery store with Muriel Latow, don't you?
No, that's actually somebody else, but we did go into the supermarket with Andy, and that was an amazing revelation because all the stuff that was really, you know, invisible, you'd go in to buy cereal or detergent or something, but suddenly all of the stuff, the detergent boxes were in these psychedelic colors and swirling. It was like an MGM musical. Suddenly this whole world was visually revealed to you. And then, the mad captains on the cereal boxes and the purple and green cereal, and everything in the place suddenly leapt into life, and it had just been below your vision all these years.
This is sort of who Warhol was for you, and for other people too, isn't it? You talk about him starting as a commercial artist, but even as a commercial artist, he wasn't a great draftsman, he wasn't a great painter, but he could see what other people had done and rearrange it. Just like walking into the supermarket and looking at the stack of cans, you'd see it, but he would see it in a different way.
Oh, absolutely. Andy, I think, is essentially a conceptual artist. And as such, he is the beginning of postmodernism, which essentially means that painters no longer needed to actually paint their own paintings. I mean, you could just point at something like Duchamp's urinal and say, that's art. Because if you think about it, Andy's images were all photographs. His paintings are really photographs of photographs. That was one of the amazing breakthroughs that he made, because photography had been the bane of painting since 1828, when Nicéphore Niépce took the first photograph, because when you had photography, what were artists going to do? They couldn't, you know, represent reality or whatever the way they had for thousands of years. They had to come up with other ways of seeing. And with the photographic silkscreen process that my sister introduced Andy to at age 14, that changed because he was presenting already existing objects, photographs, images. He wasn't painting anything. Essentially, Andy's art was no different from printing in the past. The silkscreen process being essentially printing, you could print any number of the same image in the same way that, you know, an abstract expressionist wouldn't paint, you know, exactly the same painting. I mean, not that Andy's were exactly the same, but it basically had a printing press. He really could print as many copies of that painting as he wanted and emphasize that by doing paintings where he would have the same image multiplied many times, as many as 250 times on a canvas. So it was not only in sync with the whole assembly line of commercial goods, but it also didn't distinguish itself from the things it was representing.
He didn't see a need to distinguish what he was doing from the world of consumer goods.
No, and also, I mean, I don't think he was specifically voicing this, but to sell paintings of soup cans in a gallery was really not that different from somebody selling the soup cans in a supermarket. Art had taken on an almost quasi-religious quality from Van Gogh on into abstract expressionism. Galleries were considered something almost holy when you went into them, the white walls, the hush. And here was somebody putting those very objects of commercial culture on the wall of the gallery and selling them, you know, as if they were products. In fact, when the Brillo boxes were sent to Canada for an exhibition, the customs there insisted on taxing them as if they were actual boxes of Brillo.
You might have paid lower taxes on the boxes of Brillo than you would on Andy Warhol's art. I don't know.
I would think.
David Dalton is a co-author, along with Tony Sherman, of Pop, the Genius of Andy Warhol. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1129A, Lost in the Supermarket, Consumerism. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Anthony Cefali, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.